Hi, and welcome to Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. I'm Chris Garlock. The Labor Radio Podcast Weekly is a collection of highlights from labor radio and podcast shows around the country, part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network of more than two dozen shows focusing on working people's issues and concerns. We've got links to all the network shows at dclabor.org. Click on Union City Radio. This week, the Talking Smart podcast explores the impact the COVID-19 crisis is having on members and their jobs, as well as how Smart is mobilizing across the United States and Canada to help and support members and communities in need.
We all know we're in unprecedented times, but we must get through this together. We must lean and learn from each other. Our Smart family will come together, and we are not alone as we fight this together.
The latest Teamster Nation podcast focuses on UPS Teamsters on the front lines and what the union is doing to protect the health and safety of these essential logistics workers.
So while other people are being told to stay at home, they have to get out there and they're doing their job and, you know, really helping America get through this crisis.
On the Heartland Labor Forum, labor lawyer Mark Gallas talks about how Trump's National Labor Relations Board is eroding worker rights to organize and bargain.
What they're really doing is they're helping employers drive away unions.
It was no surprise that last Thursday's opening day for the World Champion Nationals here in Washington, D.C. was canceled. But that had an effect on some very special workers, as Margaret Sharp, D.C. Organizing Director for Unite Here Local 23, tells us on this week's edition of Your Rights at Work.
The folks who serve your beer and cook your hot dog and sell merchandise, they work for subcontractors who are excluded from that commitment that the league had made.
We also have a sound collage from Union City Radio, and the story of the last days at work for a local bookseller as the nation's capital shut down.
With a sense of foreboding, loud, boisterous crowds drank away at the bar one evening. The next, according to the rules, no bar service. Finally, the announcement. The governor declared all restaurants closed.
That's all ahead on this week's edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Enjoy the show.
You're listening to Talking Smart. The official podcast of the International Association of Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, and Transportation Workers.
Talking Smart is the new monthly podcast from the International Association of Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, and Transportation Workers, a diverse union of more than 200,000 members. In the latest episode, the union's leadership talks about the impact the COVID-19 crisis is having on members and their jobs, as well as how Smart is mobilizing across the United States and Canada to help and support members and communities in need. First up, Smart General President Joseph Sellers summarizes what Smart is doing to help and support its members, both in terms of workplace health and safety and financially, as business shutdowns, layoffs, and stay-at-home directives ripple across the economy.
There's a big infusion of money, strong financial support. We need to make sure that we, workers, brothers and sisters, and their families get a piece of that. The working men and women of this country get a piece of that. Those that are protecting the front lines and those that are essential workers, those that are transporting goods and people, such as those in the freight and passenger, construction workers, production workers that are going to work every day and making sure essential operations are being done and being attended to. We will get through this together. Our Smart family will come together, and we are not alone as we fight this together. We unify for strength. We unify as a union. We unify for workplace conditions, and that's all true. We unify for wages and safety. We need to unify to make sure that our families are safe. And this means looking out for each other. It means checking on our retired members and those who are at risks and their families. We also know that we haven't peaked yet. I think we all feel a sense of uncertainty. We feel anxiety and we feel stress. And we need to know that our brothers and sisters are not just names and terms that we say and use. They are meaningful to our Smart Union family. And this is each one of you.
Next, Randy Croca, head of SMOHIT, the Sheet Metal Occupational Health Institute Trust, talks about the important work SMOHIT is doing to help members stay informed and be safe at home and on the job during the COVID-19 outbreak.
Construction industry employers also have some cautions that they should be taking to make sure that our members are safe, and that's creating a 6 feet space between workers by staggering crews to prevent droplet spreading. You have to remember a lot of these droplets on cardboard and metals, that can last anywhere from 24 hours to 3 or 4 days. So we have to keep our work areas clean.
And finally, Smart Transportation Division President Jeremy Ferguson addresses what Smart is doing to protect rail and transit members at work, what the response to COVID-19 has been from federal transportation agencies and rail carriers, and the critical role rail and transit members are playing during this time of crisis.
They're doing an amazing job. They're the backbone of this nation, and it's because of people like them that are able to go to work and do their job on the trains and on the buses that others are able to eat and keep the lights on and get to work, provide the medical attention, provide the fire protection, the police protection, whatever the case may be. I know also our passenger folks that are dealing face to face with the public. They've reported having unsanitary conditions, not only on the passenger equipment, but in the stations where the public is. They're not seeing any cleaning going on. And then they've had reports of people that are positive for COVID-19 and they have the symptoms, they're visible, but yet the conductors are having a hard time getting those passengers either off the train or getting them quarantined on the train until they can get off at the next stop. So we're dealing with every issue that gets reported to our office and trying to get the safest and most expedient solution so we can get it handled quickly. But I can't believe the pace at which these issues are coming into our office.
Talking Smart is available wherever you listen to podcasts. The latest Teamster Nation podcast focuses on UPS Teamsters on the front lines and what the union is doing to protect the health and safety of these essential logistics workers.
Welcome to this special edition of the Teamster Nation podcast focused on the coronavirus pandemic and Teamsters at United Parcel Service. I'm Kara Dennis from the Teamsters Communications Department. As the pandemic has continued to spread, Teamsters at UPS have been on the front lines in ensuring that Americans are able to get food, supplies, and other items as more and more states continue to close stores and enforce more social distancing and shelter-in-place declarations. The union's number one concern is the health and safety of our members. That's why General President Hoffa, the Teamsters Package Division, and the union's Safety and Health Department have been working nonstop to ensure that members are getting the tools they need to stay safe on the job. In today's podcast, we will be speaking with General President Jim Hoffa, Package Division Director Dennis Taylor, and Safety and Health Director Lamont Bird to get the latest update on the union's advocacy for Teamsters at UPS. General President Hoffa has been coordinating the union's response to the coronavirus epidemic in all sectors, including the 250,000 Teamsters at UPS. He's held numerous national calls with local union officers and agents, as well as division directors and union staff, to ensure that the union is responding on all levels, from contract enforcement and protections to helping members and sectors that have been decimated by this crisis. I spoke to President Hoffa to learn more about what the union is doing to help workers through the crisis. What are the priorities of the international union as the crisis continues to worsen?
Well, right now, we're looking out for our 1.4 million members, doing everything we can to protect them, to make sure they're working, to make sure they're working safe. Many of our workers, especially the UPS workers, are 250,000 strong, have been deemed essential workers. So while other people are being told to stay at home, they have to get out there and they're doing their job and, you know, really helping America get through this crisis. They're essential employees and they're at risk. So we urge them to take every precaution to make sure they're safe, wash their hands, make sure they do all the sanitary things that are prescribed by everybody, and we're going to get through this together.
Dennis Taylor, director of the Teamsters Package Division, saw the potential impact of the pandemic on UPS Teamsters and negotiated additional sick days for workers directly impacted by the virus. On March 18th, the union signed a Memorandum of Understanding, an MOU, providing up to 10 additional sick days for full-time and part-time Teamsters. I've heard talk about hazard pay and bonus pay for workers during the pandemic. What is the Teamsters' response?
Well, the package division negotiated additional paid time off in lieu of hazard pay or bonus pay over and above our contractual paid time off of up to 10 days paid at the employee's daily guarantee. This paid time off actually protects the employees by providing income during a mandatory quarantine, either imposed by the government, a doctor, medical professional, or UPS themselves. And that's money that's absolutely essential for our members. At the division, we'd heard a number of concerns that people may be coming in sick because they couldn't afford to take time off. And I want to be very clear, if you are feeling ill, if you are sick, stay home. Do not allow any supervisor, any manager to bully you into coming in to work. You put everyone at risk. Stay home. We've bargained additional pay in the event that you test positive for the coronavirus in that event. And believe me, hazard pay doesn't provide any of these kind of protections.
Have there been problems getting needed supplies in the building, like hand sanitizer, cleaning products, and nitrile gloves? Is UPS doing everything possible to get these supplies?
I believe they're working hard to get the supplies. Certainly, they were well behind the curve in the beginning of this pandemic. A lot of that stems from their being behind the curve in general cleaning for the last probably 6-8 months. But you got to keep in mind that there's a critical shortage of masks and gloves that doctors and nurses are experiencing. And while there's a lot of businesses that are retooling to produce these personal protective equipment and help alleviate the shortage, we're still several weeks away from an adequate supply for the medical community.
What's being done about UPS having two workers loading or unloading trailers?
I spoke with the company actually the day before yesterday on this issue to get some resolution to this. Certainly, the productivity has always been their number one concern. It is not our number one concern. There is no way to maintain the 6-foot distance in an 8-foot wide trailer when you've got two loaders or unloaders working side by side. So obviously that doesn't work for us. We've made that abundantly clear to the company. They have since, I believe, and it should have started this morning, have agreed that the two people will not be in the unload or the load working side by side. The only time that would be an exception would be, for instance, if I've got a loader or unloader in the nose of the trailer, and somebody might be taking hazmats off the end of the trailer where they're typically stored. We think that it would be a sufficient distance between the two But other than that, there should not be two people in the trailer.
I spoke with Lamont Bird about what the department is doing to support UPS members and provide an update on the impact of government decisions on our members.
It's my understanding that as a result of the coronavirus pandemic, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration issued an emergency declaration for commercial drivers regarding hours of service. Will this affect UPS members?
The FMCSA issued this waiver for commercial drivers who are providing direct assistance supporting emergency relief in response to the coronavirus pandemic. The hours of service waiver is effective until this emergency ends or on April 12, 2020, whichever occurs first. So this waiver effectively suspends the hours of service regulation for those drivers. It's important to understand that the waiver covers drivers who are transporting medical supplies and equipment relating to the testing, diagnosis, and treatment of COVID-19. Supplies and equipment such as masks, gloves, hand sanitizers, soap and disinfectants, food, paper products, and other groceries for emergency restocking of distribution centers or stores, raw materials such as paper, plastic, or alcohol that are required to be used for the manufacture of essential items like hand sanitizers and masks, fuel, equipment, supplies, and persons necessary to establish and manage temporary housing and quarantine, and transporting people who've been designated by federal, state, or local authorities for medical isolation or quarantine purposes. This waiver also covers drivers who are transporting people who are necessary to provide other medical emergency services. Now, in terms of whether or not this will affect UPS members, drivers that are transporting routine commercial deliveries, including mixed loads with a nominal quantity of qualifying emergency relief, are not qualified to use the emergency declaration or waiver. So unless UPS drivers are transporting goods in quantities that meet the criteria as defined by the DOT, they will not be able to use the hours of service waiver.
Okay, there was a report in the news about DOT, Department of Transportation, issuing other waivers that might affect UPS drivers. Can you give us information on those waivers?
Yeah, sure. The FMCSA granted a waiver to drivers who have expired or expiring medical certificates or commercial driver's licenses. The COVID-19 crisis has resulted in some state driver licensing agencies shutting down or having minimal staff members working. In an increasing number of states, medical facilities that normally perform DOT medical examinations are not doing these exams because doctors and other healthcare professionals are working to treat patients who have COVID-19. So in an effort to provide some regulatory relief to drivers and to give medical facilities and licensing agencies a chance to get back to normal, the FMCSA granted a extension to the drivers whose credentials expired on or after March 2020. This extension will be effective until June 30th of 2020. So those drivers will have up until June 30th, 2020 to get their credentials updated. One last issue that I'll discuss is the changes that DOT, Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, implemented to assist drivers and motor carriers who are subject to the DOT drug and alcohol testing regulations. As I discussed earlier, COVID-19 has greatly affected the availability of medical professionals and their support staff to conduct routine regulatory screenings. So if drivers and medical or motor carriers encounter difficulty scheduling drug and or alcohol testing collections, and the motor carrier is unable to collect specimens at the truck or bus terminal, the motor carrier is required to document why the testing could not be completed and submit that information to the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration as part of its normal reporting requirements.
Thank you for listening to this special edition of the Teamsters Nation podcast. Please be sure to go to www.teamster.org for the latest information on the coronavirus and what your union is doing to fight for our members.
This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, labor lawyer Mark Gallas talks about how Trump's National Labor Relations Board is eroding worker rights to organize and bargain.
You know, just this week, just a couple of days ago, the board put forth a few new rules.
Yeah,
as
I was
well.
Going to ask you about those. Yeah.
And what I find interesting is that it's always spun as dealing with employee choice, but we're here to protect the worker's choice, which is somewhat laughable. What they're really doing is they're helping employers drive away unions. I mean, this is all French.
They do it in the name of individual rights, right? You have an individual right as opposed to, you know, any kind of ability to collectively make a decision. And it the whole gist of it is that it undermines any power of the group, right?
And that's right. And you can even look back to, you know, I view labor relations as sort of a pendulum. You know, prior to the National Labor Relations Act, workers had no rights. And the pendulum was fully swung to the employer side. Well, National Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act, is passed. The pendulum starts swinging back toward employee rights. And then in the late 40s, the Taft-Hartley Act came about, which said, you know, not only does an employee have the right to join a union, but Taft-Hartley said the employee has a right to not join a union. And so Taft-Hartley is still, those are two dirty words in the labor community. But the rulemaking this week, like I said, just 2 days ago, and you have to think of it in the context of 2 weeks ago, the board essentially suspended all elections and all hearings. So as of 2 days ago, there was no opportunity for any sort of election, whether it be in person, by mail, whatever.
And this is because of the virus, right?
Because of COVID-19, that's right. So the rulemaking that came down a couple days ago, one involves what's called blocking. So under the old rule, if there were serious unfair labor practices that would render a fair election impossible, that would block an election until the unlawful conduct was remedied. Makes sense. The employer is engaging in all this unfair conduct. The election is stopped. You figure it out, and then you go forward. The new rule says that if the unfair labor practice charge is filed, the election is still conducted, but the board will impound the ballots for up to 60 days.
Right.
You know, the employers had argued that the unions were filing frivolous unfair labor practice charges in order to halt decertification elections. And, you know, they were accusing the unions of, you know, filing these charges and then rushing to the people and to the workers and saying, you know, keep the union. So again, the employer lobby, the Chamber of Commerce is a major actor in this, that again carried the day. There's something called the voluntary recognition bar. There are two ways that a union can be recognized as the exclusive bargaining representative. One is you have a show of interest, you have an election, the union is elected. The other is the union goes to an employer and says, look, I have a show of interest from 51%, 75%, 95%, and will you voluntarily recognize the union? And that is statutory. The old rule said that you had 6 months, you had to wait at least 6 months before disaffected workers could file a decertification position. And the idea was you want to give sufficient time for labor and management to meet to work out the terms of a collective bargaining agreement. Mm-hmm. The new rule says you have a 45-day window after the recognition to file your decertification petition. So the idea here is that as soon as there's the voluntary recognition, those disaffected folks can immediately act. And this rule, some of these rules were, you know, Obama creations, you know, that came about more so during the Obama administration. This old rule was in effect from at least the mid-60s until the Bush 43 administration, and then, you know, from 2011 to the present. So this is not whole cloth. You know, the old rule. And the other one had to do with pre-hire agreements in the construction industry. The construction industry is a little bit different when it comes to these pre-hire agreements. Construction workers engage in, you know, short-term or sporadic employment, and unions are a good source for trained or skilled workers. And so to preserve the right to organize, you can engage in or enter into these pre-hire agreements, you don't actually, the union doesn't actually have to show that it has majority support initially. But the key thing is, when you have a pre-hire agreement, when can you convert it to an actual collective bargaining agreement? Well, in the old rule, it was sufficient for the contract itself to say, we have majority support of the employees. But under the new rule, you have to show positive evidence. You have to show those cards, or you have to show.
So you're talking about a construction site. Okay, say they're going to hire electricians. And they don't previously have an agreement, I guess. So does that mean that all the electricians that they hire will have to vote? Is that how that works?
They're going to have to show that there's support for the union to come in there. Now, under the new rule, you have to show positive evidence of it, meaning.
Does this mean on every job, or does it, how does that work?
It could mean per every job. I mean, that's a possibility. It's making it more difficult for, unions to come into these positions, and it allows employers to find non-unionized work, and it creates.
They do the hiring. Problems. They could selectively hire a group of people who are anti-union, right?
Sure. And it's now easier to do. So the new rules this week were, as I mentioned, particularly egregious because of the suspension of the elections.
The Heartland Labor Forum broadcasts Thursdays at 6 p.m. on KKFI 90.1 FM in Kansas City, Missouri. You can also catch rebroadcasts on Friday at 5 a.m. on KKFI or streaming at kkfi.org. On the latest Your Rights at Work, I talked with Deborah Berkowitz, Worker Health and Safety Director at the National Employment Law Project, about reports of companies mistreating workers as coronavirus spreads.
The federal government has failed to ensure the safety and health of workers, including those most at risk, healthcare workers. The government has abandoned its role in not only keeping healthcare workers safe, but also supermarket, delivery, warehouse, factories, public transportation, sanitation, everybody working. So unlike, most crises, there's an agency called the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and their job is to assure that employers are protecting workers. But OSHA, even though they were asked by the AFL-CIO, by hundreds of public health professionals and worker rights organizations, as well as by many members of the House and the Senate, to issue an emergency standard that would set out the required protections for all workers, all the essential workers working right now, they have not done so. So there are no specific requirements that are enforceable in any workplace. There's no specific requirements that employers have to follow. So now you're really left with, you're just at the will of the employer. And so for unionized workers, they have really stepped up. As you know, in Washington, the unions are pushing for, like, Giant and Safeway to put shields between the customer and the consumer, to give more sick leave, to get some childcare help, to give them sanitizers. But with nurses and doctors, it's amazing to me that we don't have sort of set protections in place. And because of that, the nurses and doctors, if they don't speak out, they may never get the protection they need to keep people safe, because there's no government agency that's going to be there to help them. And if I can add one more point, and that is, we knew there was going to be a shortage of the kind of respiratory masks, the N95s and other protective equipment that healthcare workers would need. There is a national stockpile that only had about 13 million of these respirators that the administration has been very slow to find, figure out where they are, and get them out to workers. But we need like 300 million respirators in this crisis, and the administration should have months ago enacted the Defense Production Act. People probably never heard of it, but it gives the president the authority to say to makers of masks all over the country, we need your masks and you need to sell them to hospitals here in the United States as opposed to sell them overseas. And if they're not enough masks, let's produce more. So we're in a situation now where workers really have very few safety rights, and so they're risking their jobs to, you know, ask employers to protect them.
And it was no surprise that last Thursday's opening day for the World Champion Nationals here in Washington, D.C. was canceled. But that had an effect on some very special workers, as Margaret Sharp, D.C. Organizing Director for Unite Here Local 23, told us.
Good afternoon, Chris. Thanks for having me. As you said, today would have been opening day at Nationals Park, but that's not happening due to the coronavirus pandemic. However, that leaves hundreds of workers at home without the job that they were looking forward to starting. And your listeners may have heard that the league had committed $1 million per team to pay stadium workers who are out of work due to the pandemic crisis. However, the folks that you're talking about who serve your beer and cook your hot dog and sell merchandise, they work for subcontractors who are excluded from that commitment that the league had made. And so at Nats Park, there's over 1,200 concessions workers. And we as a union are calling on the Nationals to commit to pay its subcontracted food service workers for the home games that have been canceled for the season so far. We all celebrated last year that the Nationals were World Series champions. And certainly the, you know, the workers at Nats Park love the team. They love the city. You know, many of the workers there have been there for years since the stadium opened. And so everyone is incredibly excited at the World Series victory. But as a result, we would also like to see the Nationals be leaders in paying the workers who are out of work right now because the season is not happening. Frankly, these workers are among some of the most vulnerable in our city, and many of them live in the neighborhood, you know, around Nationals Park and would like to see the Nationals be a good neighbor and would like to see the team actually take care of them because, as you have said, they are a part of the fan experience of going to a game and drinking your beer and, you know, being able to enjoy the game. And so I think that it's really a shame that so far the Nationals have not made this commitment, but we're really hoping that they will because these are very, very difficult times for these workers who are at home right now.
Well, Margaret Sharp, we really appreciate what you're doing. On our website, dclabor.org, you'll find a wonderful photo of some of Margaret's members and a link so that you can sign the petition. And hopefully when we have Margaret on next week, fingers crossed, we'll have some good news to report. Wouldn't that be nice?
I certainly hope so.
Thank you, Margaret. Really appreciate it. Be safe out there.
Thanks. You too, Chris. Appreciate it.
Your Rights at Work airs Thursdays at 1 o'clock on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. You can also listen to the podcast. Just search for Union City Radio. Speaking of Union City Radio, the brief daily labor news updates are now airing 7 days a week on WPFW. Here's a sound collage from this week's shows. We start with Steve Courtien, president of the Baltimore-Washington Building Trades Council, then John Gibson, president of Teamsters 639, and then we have two clips from speeches by Martin Luther King Jr., who was assassinated on April 4, 1968, in Memphis, where he had been supporting a sanitation workers' strike. We wrap up with Joe Glazier singing Look for the Union Label. The Union Label Department was chartered by the American Federation of Labor on April 2, 1909.
Construction is inherently dangerous. Anything can happen at any time. There could be no way to prevent it. We're getting a lot of members who are concerned about, you know, am I going to have a job tomorrow? And then secondary is like, okay, well, how can I make sure I'm safe and that I'm working safe on the project? So we're trying to really just make sure that the members understand how to work safely on the project, just like we always do, just with a new threat, where before it was about falling or, you know, overhead accidents, things like that. Now we're just really trying to enforce with them about protecting themselves with social distancing, keeping your hands washed, you know, wearing gloves, all those things are just starting to get put into their, you know, their toolbox of safety.
Some of them are flourishing and some are going to take a hit. We also have folks in the casino industry over at MGM. That's pretty much shut down out there at Dulles Airport. The planes are not operating really. And so obviously that's having a huge impact on the Amtrak, the Aramark contract we have. You know, the trains aren't running as much as they were, if at all. And people just aren't traveling. So those industries are being impacted, but some others are not. Well, it is a challenge. Every day it's a challenge. And these guys go out there knowing that they're susceptible to exposure to this virus, but they do it anyway and practicing safe hygiene procedure and all that. But it is really tough. But as you said, our teams are tough.
We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists.
Whenever Pharaoh wanted to prolong the period of slavery in Egypt, he had a favorite formula for doing it. What was that? He kept the slaves fighting among themselves. But whenever the slaves get together, something happens in Pharaoh's court, and he cannot hold the slaves in slavery. When the slaves get together, that's the beginning of getting out of slavery.
Look for the union label when you are buying a coat, dress, or blouse. Remember somewhere our union's sewing, our wages going to feed the kids and run the house. We work hard, but who's complaining? Thanks to the ILG, we're paying our way. So always look for the union label. It says we're able to make it in the USA.
Union City Radio, available wherever you listen to podcasts. Wrapping up the show on the Labor History Today podcast this week, we featured Kurt Stand, who, at least until recently, was a bookseller at Busboys and Poets here in Washington, D.C. Kurt told us about his last days at work before the COVID-19 shutdown.
Worry slowly mounted over the past few weeks, but worry about what? I work at a bookstore that is part of a restaurant and event space. Since the new year, there has been, like the spread of coronavirus itself, growing concern about the disease, slight at first, then becoming deeper and more profound. For some, the danger seemed exaggerated. For others, danger signs were seen everywhere. By contrast, simultaneously, a fear spread shared equally by all my coworkers. Fear of loss of income, loss of job. That economic insecurity, more palpable, more familiar, easier to grasp and discuss, joined the nameless fear of illness. Taken together, we have lived a life of nervous anxiety. All this contributed to an odd sensibility about customers, those coming in for a meal, to attend an event, to buy a book. After all, unlike a grocery store or pharmacy, no one has to go to a restaurant. And so we wondered why folks might risk their health going out to eat. Yes, of course, we all wanted them to come, because if they didn't, our jobs would be gone. Initially, despite the looming threat, people came. Then overnight, there was a drop-off. Events were hit first, with attendance down, and then canceled. As news reports announce the virus arrival in the vicinity, numbers eating out still more. And with that, so too did book purchases. Some bought in case they should have time on their hands. Others said, quite sensibly, now might be the time to read books that for too long have been sitting on a shelf at home. Servers reliant on tips were most impacted. Each day, more staff had shorter hours. Each day, there was the hope people wouldn't be sensible. They would come in, mixed with the fear that someone infectious might enter and infect us too. Both the reality and what we thought about that reality became unsustainable as the news worsened hour by hour. New rules were set. Groups seated at a table had to be of six or less. Booths and tables where diners sat had to be separated by an empty one. People should not sit or stand at the bar. All rules that proved hard to enforce. What do you say to two couples with three children who come in for a meal? With a sense of foreboding, loud, boisterous crowds drank away at the bar one evening. The next, according to the rules, no bar service. Finally, the announcement. The governor declared all restaurants closed until the public health crisis. The last day, our regulars who come by themselves, either to work with a cup of coffee or to have breakfast alone but not alone, all showed. Then the curtain closed. The governor's decision was the correct one, no doubt. Public health is another way of describing taking care of each other. But it is not an easy road. While it is true no one has to eat out, it is also true that a shared meal outside of one's home has an intrinsic value that can't be easily measured. So, too, does browsing through a bookstore before making a purchase. The loss of such, when added to all the other closures involved in a quarantine, is real. It is a loss those of us who worked at this restaurant share in our own private lives. I began by writing that I work at a bookstore. I now have to add an ED to that word. At the stroke of a pen, we were unemployed. For some, the loss is harder than others. One co-worker was laid off from another job. Her husband's hours were cut on a job that won't last much longer either. I wished her luck as she left with her child, blithely unaware of what's going on because of the brave, friendly face she wore. I have my own challenges, as do we all living within that palpable, familiar territory of unemployment, of income loss, and just the sense of loss. And meanwhile, the nameless worry about her health, the health of her family, friends, neighbors remain, as does the unanswered question, what will we do about it?
Kurt Stand, a bookseller at Busboys and Poets here in Washington, D.C., reading Fear at Work, published on the Stansberry Forum, stansberryforum.com, where you'll find lots more great writing on labor, politics, immigration, the environment, and world affairs. Thanks for listening to Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. We hope you've enjoyed these highlights from labor radio and podcast shows around the country, part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, of more than two dozen shows focusing on working people's issues and concerns. We've got links to all the network shows at dclabor.org. Click on Union City Radio. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this has been Chris Garlock, urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local labor radio show.